Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And we're actually going to talk today about a topic that we sort of passed over a few weeks ago and I suggested as a topic. But to give a little bit more background to it than that, a few years ago, a friend of mine, Patch, phoned me up and he asked me whether I could appear in a play that he was putting on, a play called Return of the Three Musketeers. And I'm a busy man, you know, it was right in the middle of the summer season, right when I'm busiest. And I said to him, what do you actually need me to do? And he said, just sword fight. Come along, have a sword fight. I need you to play a baddie, just put on a mask, put on a costume, run at the enemy, have a sword fight and die. I thought, okay, I can cope with that. That doesn't sound like it's going to take a lot of extra prep work or rehearsal or anything else like that. That's absolutely fine. So he said, brilliant, thanks for that. Come along this week, come along to rehearsal this Friday night. And so I thought, yeah, okay, I'll come along and help you out. And I'd not actually done, despite all of my background in theatre and everything, one thing I've never done is amateur dramatics. I've always worked professionally. And so this was my first foray. And I turned up and I went in and I sat down and he said, oh, there you go. Have a script to have a little look at. And obviously my spider senses started tingling because I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I was told I need to hit a couple of swords together. What am I doing with a script? All the cast gathers round and he sits there and he says to the entire cast, okay, oh, I'd like to introduce you all to Greg. Greg is going to play Monsieur Treville, the captain of the guards. At which point in time I turned to the script and saw that the first page was full of lines for Captain Treville. At which point in time I looked at him and he said, and I've just remembered, I've not discussed this with Greg in advance. and obviously once I'd taken that part on, I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. I owe you a favour. I did, just as a sideline, I have got my own back on him when I've actually cast Patch in the web series I'm working on, The Last Airship. And the first thing that I sent him was a sextant, the old navigation instrument. And I just sent that to him with a little note saying, I expect you to know how to use this by the time filming begins. So, you know, I like to get my own back. But the fact of the matter is, once I started playing that part, I wanted to know a little bit about the characters. And I had always assumed that the Three Musketeers were entirely fictional. I would always assume that Alexandre Dumas, who wrote the books, had just entirely created this story. And when I started looking into it, I was surprised at how much historical basis there was for quite a lot of it, actually.
I would agree. And I think before we go any further, I think it's worth apologising to our French listeners, such as Dr. Prieur. We know you're listening to this. I'm going to apologize in advance for us butchering French names because we're going to do that at some point here. Now, as good as our attempts to try and pronounce things in the French way, we're going to get things wrong, aren't we?
We certainly are. But I would like to say that on that particular basis, we are going to stick to the British tradition of pronouncing them the way we think they should be pronounced and glossing over it. So we do apologise if anyone's offended by that. But
yeah, absolutely. So the thing about the Musketeers is they were a real unit and they were kind of like the elite bodyguard in the 1600s and 1700s of the French royals, basically. They were expanded. I mean, this is a little bit, do you remember we did a few months back, Imperial Guards? Okay, I guess this is sort of the Royal Guards is sort of fits into the same territory as that. Funnily enough, they were absolutely, they were disbanded once for, I think, for budgetary reasons, for sort of the, you know, they're just a bit too expensive. They're trying to tighten their belts. It's of all the things to tighten your belts on, maybe stop building Versailles and make sure you've got the guards, but no, they cut back on the guards. But obviously the French Revolution's going to sort out the King's Guard, basically. So they were definitely a thing for about 150 years, and they were seen as the absolute elite forces of the French king. And they were the musketeers, but I think the full name was the Musketeers of the Guard. I believe, and they weren't just, I mean, if you like, it's a slightly weird name because a musketeer literally is a guy standing there firing a musket, but these guys could do that. but they also rode around on horses. So they could act as light cavalry. They could also, you know, fight hand to hand with swords. I mean, not literally hand to hand, but you know, with swords. So they were kind of the real deal. And therefore, when you think of TV series like The Three Musketeers, which in no way tries to be historically accurate, but you know, the fun movies of the Musketeers and blah 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 blah. I mean, it's almost a cottage industry, The Three Musketeers. Sort of the idea of the derring do, and they can kind of do anything and fight anyone, that's not far off what they actually were like. Now, they didn't tend to go off gallivanting on adventures. They were a military unit that were required to fight within the context of a battle or a siege. You know, you didn't just send three of them off for a jolly adventure, but, you know, that makes a good story.
I think one of the things you just touched on there is part of the reason I'd completely missed the, for a long time, the real historical side of this was the fact that we do tend to get these nice jaunty series about it. Like you say, there's a nice jaunty history of, well, the nice jaunty BBC one that's just been on, lots of fun, lots of historically inaccurate costumes and language and everything else, but it's just good fun. It's not supposed to be historically accurate. And just in case anyone's confused, anyone, I think, particularly of my generation, but possibly slightly older than me as well, don't get confused. We're not telling you that Dogtanyan is real, okay? That's... but again...
Now that's unfair, because now that theme tune stuck in my head. Oh, God.
Great, and I'd forgotten the theme tune, and now it's in mine as well.
Yeah, well, you started it.
But the basic fact of
the lady, the mysterious cat. Okay. Anyway, we could go down that rabbit hole.
But the point is again, my first introduction to the story was certainly the Dogtanyan films. This lovely little cartoon about a dog wanting to be a musketeer with a broken sword and all of this. And then I think probably after that, and if you want another theme tune stuck in your head after that, it was Albert the Fifth Musketeer was probably the next recognition I had before I actually got to...
Oh, I don't know that one, so I'm safe on theme tunes.
Oh, good. Well, don't look it up, because it's now stuck in my head as well. It's pushed Dogtanyan out, luckily, though. So, but it's one of those things where I started off with a couple of cartoon versions of it, and then you kind of start watching the films, and they're this fun adventure and all of this... And so it's very easy. Obviously, I was aware that the Musketeers were in some way a real unit. But the extent to which there was reality in it is fascinating. The fact, you know, I didn't realise, for example, that D'Artagnan, Athos were based on real musketeers. I assume that these were completely fictionalised characters.
Well, do you know what? It was only when we were researching for this episode that I discovered the other ones were real guys too. But I did know, deep breath, that Charles Ogier de Batz de Castelmore, Comte d'Artagnan, is D'Artagnan. He's one of these rare people where, no, he didn't do anything that was in the books. But if you want somebody who was very much like the fictional version, he was. And he was an amazing, military officer that fought in war after war after war. And he was in his 60s when he died at the siege of Maastricht. So this is a guy who, quite frankly, should have retired, should have died multiple times prior, but did actually eventually die. I'm sorry, I just killed D'Artagnan on this on this podcast. But, you know, it was a real guy. And boy, did he dodge the bullets over the decades that he was fighting in Europe. A remarkable man. And in a way, I think we've sort of spoken in the past about how people didn't want to be remembered in history. But I think that he would turn around and go, okay, I didn't do those things, but that's actually, yeah, I'm happy with how people remember my name. A pretty cool dude. And just while I'm on the topic of sort of reality versus fantasy, the thing that tickled me when I was sort of, you know, years ago when I was looking into D'Artagnan is that the musketeers worked very closely with the advisors of the king, including Cardinal Richelieu. Now, if there's a name that you associate with the musketeers sort of TV shows and stories, it's Cardinal Richelieu, who is always the moustache twirling bad guy, who actually in real life was the guy quite often giving the missions to the musketeers, and they all got on famously.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that struck me about Cardinal Richelieu in particular, and Captain Dreville,
another real
is
person,
when you start another real person. But once you start researching Dreville, you can't escape the fact that it was actually Dreville who tried to have the cardinal assassinated, and was actually he was kicked out of the court. He was exiled from the court because he had tried to, and you think of Cardinal Richelieu in the books, he's the creepy one, you know, Captain Dreville is, he's upstanding, he's this very proper guy. He was the one, because you did have this rivalry between the two of them going on, and between the musketeers and the cardinal's guards, just as we see in the books and the films. But it was actually Dreville in the end who got exiled for trying to sneakily get rid of the cardinal rather than the other
way
around.
Now, Richelieu is a brilliant topic. Maybe we should do a podcast on him at some point. But he was involved in, and this is something that we've I've mentioned previously, the 30 Years' War, which was a hugely damaging war to Central Europe. America, France got involved towards the end of it. The beginnings of it was very much Protestant versus Catholic, but by the end of it, you actually have Catholic versus Catholic, just to make things more difficult. And Richelieu is, he's one of those examples where if he'd been born a few centuries later, people would have thought he's a pretty cool guy. But what you've got is, and I know that this has been a thing throughout the whole of the medieval era, you have a cardinal, a man of faith, and yet he's very much heavily involved in the politics. But if you look at people like Louis XIV, the Sun King, you know, he, one of the amazing things about him is he was, although he was incredibly powerful, he had the wonderful quote, "I am the state," but he was confident enough in his own abilities and the power of France that he would surround himself with very powerful, smart, capable people like Richelieu, for example, who, and later Mazarin is the one that people forget. He was basically the direct successor of Richelieu. And really, if you're going to use modern parlance to what these guys were doing, they were the prime ministers. They were the ones sort of supervising the government, which, but because he was a cardinal and because there were a number of wars, a lot of people very easily just sort of said, no, that makes him the bad guy. He's obviously some scheming so-and-so. And it's worth remembering that all of this comes from Alexandre, you said Dumas, I think it's Dumas is how you'd say it in France, but I will probably get corrected on that as well. But he was writing the Three Musketeers in the 1840s. So this is after Napoleon. This is after the revolution. And therefore, although France to this day is quite Catholic, I think there was more of a, it was easier to portray a powerful churchman as a bad guy than it would have perhaps been during the actual life and times of Richelieu. Of course, his enemies would portray him that way. But what Dumas was doing was, just taking some names that were still echoing around in the 19th century and thinking, oh, let's mash them together and turn them into a boy's own story. A bit like when we were talking about pirates and saying, well, what Stevenson did was he took what was exciting and exotic and cool of the time and turned it into a book, and we kind of got stuck there. And again, if both of them were writing today, they'd probably be writing about giant robots or spaceship pilots or something like that.
I would like to question that Alexandre Dumas, however we're going to say his name, actually, you know, sort of just took these names and crammed together to a story, because I think that the history is slightly more interesting than that, and it's part of the confusion about whether or not this is actually historical, how much it was. Because he actually based, and if you want to hear a name be massacred, get ready for this one. He actually based the book on a 17th century book called Memories de D'Artagnan by Gatien de Colis de Sandra.
What's that in English?
And I'm so sorry for the accent as well.
What's that in English then?
It's The Memories of D'Artagnan by Gatien de Colis de Sandra, obviously. Which was a book that he read, and it's essentially, that is what he based the first part of the Musketeers book on. And he thought at the time he was writing, this is what I gather, he thought at the time of writing that he was basing the first part of the book on somebody else's novel from a couple of hundred years before. And so in the beginning of the book, he says, you know, this is all historical, because he didn't want to be accused of plagiarizing someone else's story. He wanted to pretend that he was just writing about history. And then later on, it was then discovered that actually the original story was historically based. So the first part of the book, at least, although it's changed and modified and I believe brought forward in time a little bit for Dumas' novel, it did actually have a base. The actual whole story itself did have a basis in an earlier work. Same as someone like Shakespeare going around just nicking stories and then making them slightly better and more famous.
You know, I mean, in essence, I was saying that these were sort of famous names that were still hammering around. And it was sort of a romantic era. It was a time when France was very much at its peak. You know, the this is the thing. We poke fun at the French. And it's interesting that they do lose a number of wars. For example, the Napoleonic Wars were ultimately a military defeat for France. However, if you look at the amount of battles won versus the amount of battles lost, even in that overall defeat, they won a lot more than they lost. And it was pretty much the same thing in the 1700s and in the 1600s as well. The French did not win all the wars, but they were the army to beat. If you could beat the French army, you knew you had a good army, because they were just so consistent. So to pick something at a time which was a little bit more romantic, and you could be misty-eyed about it, you know, you got France at its peak of power, you got the king still there. I mean, so yes, it may have had a historical setting, but it was, as I was saying, he was picking something that would peak interest. He was trying to write. This was not a navel gazing, inward looking, philosophical treatise. He was trying to write a popular story, like today, Despicable Me 3 is clearly just trying to make you laugh. It's just trying to entertain you. And I apologize for now comparing the Three Musketeers to Despicable Me 3, but you get my point that it was on the sliding scale of worthy up to just fun. It was more towards the fun element rather than let's explore the nature of humanity. That was other French philosophers doing that kind of stuff.
I'd like to, instead of using Despicable Me as an example, because I was thinking along the same lines there, but instead of Despicable Me, I'd like to leap in with the example of, I know it's a slightly older film, I can't think of a direct example immediately off the top of my head for today, but The Great Escape.
I thought you were going to go to Indiana Jones, because there's sort of this romp within a historical setting.
I very nearly did go to Indiana Jones, but I think Great Escape works more accurately with this particular one, because The Great Escape, the film, is based on real events, real people, the same as The Three Musketeers is. But at the same time, they didn't have any qualms about going in, about saying, look, Steve McQueen's popular, he's got a motorbike, we know there were no Americans involved, we know we're going to make a character up, we know there was no bike chase, we know this is all
ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's almost like he's in his own
but
movie,
let's just
isn't it?
Yeah. Stick it in. Yeah, let's stick this into the film as well. You know, we don't mind. In the same way that, like the whole character of M'lady, who we just touched on earlier, she's got no real historical basis. He just stuck her into the film.
Yeah, there weren't many talking cats, to be fair, in history.
Well, cat or human, because, I mean, she's not actually a cat in the book.
But yeah, you're right. She is a recurring character, and she doesn't exist.
And and I think that's much more the sort of thing. It's taking a real historical event and then jazzing it up. Really, because The Great Escape, I mean, the story of The Great Escape, if you've ever read the original account, the original book, is fascinating enough. But when they stuck it on film, obviously they had to make it a bit more visual, you had to have all this going on, and sticking in a character like Hiltz is very much like Dumas just writing his book and saying, well, I'll tell you what, I've got these stories, but I'm just going to jazz them up, I'm going to twist them, turn and make them in my own way, and play with it like that. And I think that is where you then start to get confusion, because I do a little piece, one of my show pieces, obviously, with the escapology and history combined. Great Escape is the obvious one to go for, which I do end in the classic way of, instead of having a motorbike, I do have my little unicycle that makes the escape, of course. But I do a whole escape from a sack and chains, and I do it as this huge extended metaphor of the Great Escape. But the bottom line there is I have had people come up to me after my show and say to me, I thought that was just a film. I didn't know it really happened. And I think that is one of the dangers a lot of the time in fiction like this, where we start to bend the truth and we go into areas where it does get a little bit exaggerated, that you can then wipe the whole thing out and say, well, the whole thing is fiction in your mind. And I think that's probably what I did with The Musketeers, to be honest, for a long time.
Well, I mean, yeah, as a child, it's kind of hard to work out what is and isn't real, because everybody's sort of protecting you from the real world. And so you just assume that, well, particularly if it's animated and with animals, it's clearly all just made up. You don't realize there really was a Cardinal Richelieu and there really was this era of history, etc. And also it's also worth stating that the Musketeers were popular and also existed in the 1600s and the 1700s, which just seems to be a blind spot everywhere. You know, we do not talk about the British history of the 1600s and the 1700s, anything like we do the Tudors, as discussed in previous series, or in the 1800s, we get to the Victorian era and so on and so forth. Same in France, same in America. So, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, lots of things were happening. But I guess one of the problems whenever you start doing this, like I recently wrote an article on the War of Austrian Succession, I know also this is the era of the Franco-Dutch War and the era of the War of Spanish Succession. These were really complicated wars, to understand their causes and effects. And in essence, the last war that was a bit like those wars was World War One. Looking at exactly why World War One started, you have to understand all the interlocking alliances and power playing between, you know, Serbia was allied with Russia and da-da-da-da-da. And it's all hugely complicated and also not a lot ultimately changed. You know, it's like, oh, and after all this entire war, Silesia, an area that I have no idea where it is, but it is a part of Europe, Silesia was ceded from Austria to Prussia. Okay, Prussia isn't a place that exists anymore either. It's really hard to get your head around any of this history. It doesn't feel very relevant. And when you put the Musketeers into this area that's almost like a backwater of history, it's very easy to garner legends from that. It would be much harder to do something legendary from World War II. You would spot it a mile off more so. I mean, I know we've just said the Great Escape, but more people will know the Great Escape is real than isn't. And same thing with Indiana Jones. But you know, actually, when you get to, let's go back to Dunkirk for a moment, or go back to Saving Private Ryan, etc., there's actually a real hunger to make these things authentic, real, you know, as real as we can possibly make it. But if you're living in an era where your stories just exist in something which nobody cares about the history, nobody understands the history, you can write whatever you want.
Well, just before we move on to with the discussion, I do just want to make sure everyone has the plug. Do make sure you do check out Jem's next book, which will be called Serbia Was Allied to Russia in DDDDDA. That's going to be... It's going to be your popular, really short history of the world.
Hey, look, if Frank Sinatra can say Scooby Dooby Doo in some of his songs, then I can say...
Well, we're moving towards the end, and I think that what we've ended up again talking about in a roundabout way is fiction and how fiction can get confused with fact. But I just want to end up with one of the Musketeers for my last point, and I want to end up with Athos.
Okay.
Because, you know, researching, and they're all based on real people, and Athos was, and I apologise again, Athos was Armand de Silliel, Seigneur d'Athos et de Hauteville, apparently.
Naturally.
But that's why we're going to call him Athos for now. But Athos, he was a real-life musketeer. He was one of the king's musketeers. And he died in 1643 in Paris. And there's not a lot more about him, you know, sort of historically recorded, except for the fact that he does have his death certificate. And it is indicated in his death certificate that in 1643 in Paris, he died as a result of a duel. Now, is there anything more Three Musketeers? If you've got to hear that one of the Three Musketeers died, they should go in a duel. I think that is about as Three Musketeers as you get.
Well, so, yes and no, in the sense that, yes, that fits into the whole style. But surely, if you're one of the good guys, you shouldn't die in the duel. The other guy should die in the duel, or you just cut them on their cheek and go, that is satisfaction served, or something like that. But that's the thing about reality. Good guys die too.
Yes, indeed. Now, that's all I got, Jem. Have you got any last point you want to wrap us up on?
Well, I mean, if you've just said how one of the musketeers died, let's just briefly say D'Artagnan. So he was at the siege of Maastricht in 1673. I think he would have been in sort of 61, 62 years old, and he got shot in the throat. So it would have been a fairly quick way to go. But there you go. One of the great heroes of fiction died in Holland, shot in the throat. So sorry, guys, that's how he died. But if you look at his career and how many times he fought, and prior to that, he was governor of Lille. He'd made his way up to the commander of the musketeers, and then he was sort of allowed to have like a peacetime job. He was rubbish at being governor of Lille, and he clearly wanted to get back into fighting. So he went the way he would have wanted to go.
And well, that's all we got on the Musketeers in. So in a couple of months' time, watch out for our sequel episode, The Truth Behind Leonardo DiCaprio in The Man in the Iron Mask, I think.
Oh, Lord, no. anyway, right. Do we want a what if, or are we going to go straight to goodbye?
I think we got time to fit in a very quick what if. What have you got for me?
I've been mulling this one over. What if human beings had never worked out you could use wood to build things?
Okay, if human beings had never worked out you could use wood to build things, well, we were starting out in caves. So let's go back to we're cavemen, we're living in caves, we haven't got any wood. The first thing we're going to lose is we're going to lose just basic tools. You think of something like a hammer you've got, or a spear. Our very basic tools work on a very simple principle of tie it to a stick.
Yes.
That is the very basic principle. Now, there's a really worrying thing about this, because you've got to make a hammer. Now, we've got the cavemen sitting there. They can bash rocks with stuff. They can still make knives out of stone. They can still make everything else. Eventually, they'll figure out how to make bricks. They'll figure out how to make cement. They'll figure out how to make everything else. And so in that way, I don't think wood would ultimately have changed the world in any significant way, other than one, Gem, and that is the most significant way possible. Because I want you to imagine the caveman. Way back in the day, his job is tying the stones onto a stick to make a rudimentary Neolithic hammer. Now, when he ties his stone onto the end of the stick, what he's got is he's got a big stick that's heavy at one end. And he's bored because he's just been tying stones to stick all day. And he just sits there with his stick, with the stone in, and he just throws that stick up in the air. It spins around nicely, and he catches the other end. And so after a while, he thinks, oh, hang on, what if I get two of these sticks with stones on?
Oh,
and
Lord.
I try throwing them both up in the air. And then it moves on to three. And that, I think, probably was the origins of juggling. Now, if he'd never tied those stones to those bits of wood, we would never have juggling clubs. If we didn't have juggling clubs, we'd never have figured out juggling knives. If we didn't have juggling knives, I wouldn't have a career. I'd be absolutely in trouble. So I think essentially, Jem, if we'd never use wood as a building material, the world would be essentially the same, except that it would be a much darker, sadder place for the lack of juggling, and in particular, the lack of my illustrious career.
Well, fear not, because there's these things called apples. If you pick three of those, you could juggle those.
Yeah,
so fear not.
The balls
I'm pretty
are boring.
Sure someone would have. Well, there we go. All right, thank you very much for that, Greg. It's plug time. So it's been a while since I've plugged a book. I'm going to plug my Forgotten History book. It's still out there. It's got over 180 different little stories there. You want to know the truth about Nazi super cows? That's a real thing. You want to know about the most dangerous chemical we've ever invented? That's a thing called chlorine trifluoride, but also known as substance N. Or if you want to know about how all cavemen were actually communists, seeing we've just found out that they also invented juggling, all that and so much more. All available on Forgotten History, which you can get from, segue to Greg,
Okay, you can get that by going to condensedhistories.com/gems. You'll actually find links there to all of Gems' books. I've got to say, still, I think, in my personal opinion, I'm still torn between Deus Vult, which I think is it still your only extended history book about a single subject, really?
Yes, it is.
And Forgotten Histories. They're such different genres of book, it's hard to compare those two. But of the rest of your books, Forgotten Histories is far and away my favourite of your books. I really did enjoy that one.
Thank you. I really did
enjoy the other ones as well. I'm not saying they were rubbish. But also, while you're checking out condensedhistories.com/gems to get the links to our books, make sure you also just click on the tour guide on condensedhistories.com. Find out where I am over the summer. Come along, see one of my shows. I'm all over the country. I must be local to you at some point. Come over. And if you come and see one of my shows, do come over and say hello and say that you listen to the podcast, because nothing makes me and Jen happy. Okay, I'm going to start again. Nothing makes me and Jem happier than when one of you comes over and we find out you are a listener to the podcast. So I think that's all we got time for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to everyone who is reviewing the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're listening. That does us a great deal of help. Thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducciu.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye and take care.